Property characteristics and site-specific research. Property characteristics. Let's briefly recap on where we are at and how this leads us onto the current module. In module one, you got market ready. You got yourself into a position to move forward in your investing. In module two, you set your goals and identified what it is you are working towards. In module three, you selected your general location of interest and target strategy. Then in the last module, module four, you worked through a strategic approach to finding the deal, from researching the characteristics specific to your chosen strategy, street-focused research, and then property-focused research. Now you are at the stage of honing in on the actual deal and doing site-specific research on properties, really drilling down into the property characteristics. When looking at the required characteristics of a property, this is very specific to the strategy you are undertaking, and for this reason, this module has been broken into manufactured growth strategies and income strategies. The property characteristics relevant to each strategy have been detailed, and then the process of researching these characteristics is stepped through. Manufactured growth strategies. In module three, you were introduced to the range of manufactured growth strategies. These are strategies where you actively do something to the property to increase its value. Whether that's increased value in the form of equity, if you intend to hold, or profit created from selling the property, or a combination of the two. Also, remember that manufactured growth strategies are equally as applicable to residential, commercial, and industrial property, and the research process is very similar across the various property classes. Let's work through each of the strategies and the property characteristics that need to be considered for each. Just keep in mind, though, that there is never a perfect deal. Not every deal will tick the boxes of every characteristic. There are certainly some characteristics that are more critical than others, and these will be highlighted as we go through. Some characteristics are non-negotiable. Others may be less so and may just cost you more money to address or may result in the deal taking longer to do. Either way, you just need to understand the potential impacts. Subdivision. The strategy of subdivision is to break one piece of land into smaller land parcels. Obviously, scale has relevance, and it could be subdividing a standard residential block into two, or it could be much larger subdivision of 10, 20, or even 100 plus blocks. Below is a list of the property characteristics relevant to doing a subdivision strategy. Land size. The council town plan in your location of interest will specify the minimum land size available to be subdivided. The plan will also specify the minimum land size per lot, and that will allow you to calculate the number of potential lots you can create. For example, if the minimum land size able to be subdivided is 800 square metres, and if the minimum lot size is 400 square metres, then clearly an 800 square metre block can potentially be divided into two 400 square metre blocks, whereas a 1,200 square metre block could potentially be divided into three 400 square metre blocks or two 600 square metre blocks. In order to find a property that has potential to be subdivided, conducting a search based on land size is usually your first step. You will find that most real estate websites will allow you to filter your search based on a selection of criteria, land size being just one of them. For example, using realestate.com.au and our 800 square metre example, you would specify your location or locations of interest and then click on the More Refinements button and filter the search by entering 800 square metres into the minimum land size. Below is a screenshot of this search. When you then open up the listing for a particular property, the land size will generally be listed at the bottom of the description. Investar is another search tool that many of you will choose to use owing to its flexibility. What is meant by flexibility is that with Investar, you can still filter on land size as described above, but you can also do keyword searches. And it also allows you to specify in your search particular strategies, including subdivision. Below is a screenshot of this search. Remember that most programs like Investar have online tutorials that walk you through the program, teach you how to use it, and how to get the most out of it. It is highly recommended that you spend the time working through these tutorials to ensure you are using these programs to their fullest. Zoning. The council zoning is equally as relevant as land size for a subdivision strategy. This is because many council town plans allow a smaller land size to be subdivided in medium and high density zonings. As the name suggests, these latter zonings are designed for higher density housing, where council wants to encourage a larger number of dwellings in these areas, because they are typically close to infrastructure like transport, shops and the like. For example, in a low-density zoning, the minimum land size might be 800 square metres. Hence, you would require a 1600 square metre block in order to subdivide. In contrast, in a medium-density zoning, the minimum land size might be 300 square metres, and hence a 600 square metre block of land could potentially be divided into two lots. Alternatively, in a rural zoning, the minimum land size might be 10 acres. Hence, you would need at least 20 acres to have the potential to subdivide. Clearly, understanding the impact of zoning is critical. The way to accommodate zoning in your search for a property is to firstly understand the location of the zones of interest to you. We covered that in the mapping section of the previous module. Then, with most searching tools like realestate.com.au, you can reflect the location of your search results on a map. See the screenshot below. That way, you can now see the location of each of the properties on the map, and you will be able to narrow down those that are within the zoning you are interested in. Block frontage width. The frontage width of a property is the length of the block that fronts the road. This has relevance for subdivision because it impacts on the street presence of the new block being created, and it affects the capacity to provide multiple driveways to the new created blocks. For this reason, most council town plans will specify a minimum block frontage width, for example 10 metres, and blocks under that dimension may be more difficult to have approved for subdivision. Remember, these are only examples, and this is where you need to have researched the town plan in your chosen area, as detailed in the previous module. The method for determining a property's frontage width, and in fact the perimeter dimension of the whole block, is from resources like RP Data and PDS Live, where they provide a map of the property. Alternatively, the mapping feature on realestate.com.au allows you to zoom in on the property and you can get a rough estimate using the scale on the map. Otherwise, the real estate agent should be able to provide this information, as can the council town planning section. Certainly remember that all of the above methods, including you measuring the block frontage on the ground, are only estimates. A definitive measure can only be determined by a licensed surveyor actually surveying the boundary, but we will cover this more in the due diligence module later in the program. Slope. The slope of the property refers to the steepness of the site. A relatively flat site would be less than 5% slope. 5 to 15% is a moderate slope, and above 20% is generally classed as a steep slope for development. Slope clearly affects the ease of building on the block, the need for retaining walls, and it affects the water runoff from the site. If a sewer system exists, it affects the capacity for pipework to deliver sewer to the sewer main piping, remembering that poo does not run uphill. For all of these reasons, Council's planning scheme will typically state a maximum slope that is able to be subdivided, or the minimum land size that can be subdivided off with a given slope. Typically, 10% is the standard, and properties above 10% slope have restrictions regarding subdivision. As alluded to above, the direction of the slope also has relevance, as it affects the capacity for water and sewer to run off the block. If you are looking at a sloping block, you typically want the slope to be falling towards the road, as that is where the storm water and sewer pipes are generally located. Obviously, it's also beneficial for water runoff to move away from a dwelling, not towards it. While the slope direction may not prevent you subdividing a block, it certainly will impact on the ease, cost, and time frame to complete a subdivision, hence why it needs to be considered. Slope is not a standard characteristic quoted for a property, and it is generally an estimate figure until the stage of getting an actual survey completed on the site. One method for estimating in the early stages, though, is to read off the contours on a contour map of the area, which is sometimes available on the council website or from the council planning front desk. Alternatively, you can make an estimate on the ground by measuring the amount of fall over a given distance of land. Landmarks like existing retaining walls can also give an indication and can be picked up from site photographs. Services location. The location of services means the existence and location of the water main, sewer main, stormwater main, plus electrical lines, phone lines, and gas main lines. The location of these services is relevant for subdivision because council will typically require any newly subdivided blocks to be able to be connected to these services if they already exist in the area. For example, if the area is currently supplied with sewer, water, stormwater, electrical, and phone services, council will typically require you to prove that the new blocks can be serviced by these existing services. In some instances, you will be required to actually create the new connections as part of the subdivision process. Whereas in other instances, You may just need to provide evidence to council that the connections can be made, for example by providing a letter from the power supplier or Telstra. Clearly, the location of the existing services has relevance, as it can significantly affect the cost of connecting to these services, the ease with which it can be done, and the duration of time it would take. For example, a power pole at the front of your property can affect the configuration of your subdivision and the positioning of driveways. A sewer main running through your property can require an easement over it and impact on the location of where you can build, plus the ease with which you can connect to services. Alternatively, a sewer main located across the road can require you to have to pay for an under-road bore to connect into it, as with a water main across the road. In the event of the sewer main ceasing at distance from the property, you may in fact be required by council to extend the main to reach the newly subdivided property, and this all comes at a cost to you. All of these services are typically underground, apart from above-ground power pole and transmission lines that are common in older established areas. Locating these underground services is therefore not easily done on site on the ground. Instead, you need to get access to the services maps for your property of interest. The most efficient method is to register online with Dial Before You Dig and request these maps. Although, depending on the council, they may or may not register these services with Dial Before You Dig, and so assessing the council records directly is the only alternative. This can be done over the counter with the planning department or through their GIS, Geographical Information Services section. Because the various infrastructures may be owned by different organisations, you ultimately will need to know this, as you may need to access the services maps directly from them. The main exception to what has been described above is where the property is rural and in fact is not serviced by the utilities described above, but instead has water tanks, septic, and even maybe solar power rather than electricity. In this instance, council may not require you to have to connect to these services, but rather supply your own when doing a subdivision. Position of the existing dwelling and structures. When doing a subdivision when you intend to retain the existing dwelling or built structures on site, the location of those structures is significant. This is because they can affect the configuration of the subdivision, the positioning of driveways, and connection to services. Awkwardly positioned structures can clearly make or break being able to do a subdivision. Obviously, you can move structures like houses and sheds, depending on their type of construction, but this also comes at a cost to the project and needs to be accounted for. There are several ways to determine the position of structures remotely from your desktop without actually having to measure on the ground. On the internet, use the likes of Google Earth and even realestate.com.au mapping tool in Map View, which shows built structures as an outline, or in satellite view, which shows it as an aerial photo. Ultimately, though, a site survey will be required to determine the exact position. Environmental constraints and council overlays. Most council planning schemes will have a range of constraint overlays that may impact on your property and affect its capacity to be subdivided. These are typically environmental parameters that have been mapped for the region, for example, flood, waterway, overland flow, native vegetation, bushfire, koala habitat, and slope overlays. There may also be other constraints, including cultural heritage, building height, and road hierarchy overlays, to name a few. A couple of screenshot examples below have been included so you can see what is being referred to. Understanding the importance of these constraint overlays on your strategy is critical. For example, in some councils, if your property is flood affected, you may not be able to subdivide it. This is because council does not want to increase the number of people and properties potentially exposed to flooding hazard. Alternatively, if your property is within a native vegetation protection zone, you may not be able to clear the native vegetation on your land, and this may restrict your capacity to subdivide. It is important to remember, though, that the mapping conducted on a council-wide basis may not in fact be accurate to your specific property, and there is definite scope to negotiate with council on this front. For example, if your property is located in a native vegetation protection zone, according to the council mapping, but in fact your property is completely clear of native vegetation, then this can be brought to the council's attention. Alternatively, if your property is on the boundary of a flood-affected area, according to the council flood overlay map, you may be able to demonstrate to council via an engineering flood report or hydraulic study that in fact your property is not flood affected. Obviously, these extra reports and consultant advice will come at a cost to the project and add time to the process. As has been alluded to, these overlay maps are council specific and should be available on the council website, otherwise via an over-the-counter inquiry with the council town planning department or with a private consultant town planner. Capacity to move the existing dwelling, demolish it or demolish part. Subdividing a property may only be achievable by moving the existing dwelling, completely demolishing it or demolishing part of it. Your capacity to actually do this will be affected by several factors. Firstly, the construction style of the building will dictate if it is able to be moved. For example, a slab on ground property is unlikely to be able to be moved, whereas an elevated building is more suitable. The cost implications to move or partly demolish may also be a limiting factor. The age and style of the building may also have an influence, particularly if the council has restrictions in place. In Queensland, some councils will not allow you to move or demolish a dwelling built prior to 1945, as they are wanting to retain the streetscape appearance of the area. Council may also have a heritage overlay or demolition control overlay that prevents you demolishing any property within that designated area. Obviously, understanding these restrictions for your location is critical, because if the only way you can do a subdivision is to demolish the existing dwelling, but in fact you are in a demolition control zone, then clearly the subdivision may not be approved. As with the environmental overlays described above, there are always exceptions. For example, if the property is in a very poor state of disrepair, and you may be able to prove to council via a structural engineer's report that the dwelling is unsound for habitation and hence demolition is appropriate. Alternatively, you may be able to prove via historical photographs and other documentation that in fact the dwelling was built post 1945, or you may be able to prove via a heritage architect's report that the dwelling is not of cultural significance. These are not guaranteed outcomes though, and so you need to be fully aware of these factors, because they certainly could make a block unable to be subdivided. Again, council is the source of this information, or a private consultant town planner. In some localities, you may find properties where there are two or more lots of land, but they are shown on the one title, which means they can only be sold together. There are several reasons why they may have come to exist. For example, a previous owner may have owned both blocks, and to save on council rates, they chose to put them on the one title, where only one rates is now payable. Alternatively, the owner may have built a house over the two lots, or when the blocks were originally created, because of their small land size or frontage, they were grouped together. Maybe one of the blocks didn't have legal access rights, and so again they were put on the one title. The quickest way to identify these blocks is online via an aerial map or a street map view of the area, for example in Google Maps. As you zoom in, the property boundary outline should be shown and also the street numbers. From there, you can see if a house has been built over two lots or if the street number appears to sit over the two lots. Regardless of the reason, how they may have come about, in most cases, these types of properties remain as two approved blocks of land, and you can apply to the titles office to have the existing title lifted and two new titles created, effectively allowing you to now sell the two lots separately. This process is not strictly a subdivision, but may be more appropriately referred to as a title lift. The treatment of these types of properties is again council specific, but often, because the lots already exist, council does not need to reapprove them, and it is more a titles department process. Clearly, this is much more streamlined than a full subdivision approval process that requires council approval plus titling. Understanding these opportunities in your area and the council's treatment of them is clearly beneficial to you, as a title lift can cost significantly less and be done much quicker than a full subdivision. This information will be able to be sourced directly from council or via a private consultant town planner. Boundary reconfiguration. Another variation on a true subdivision is a boundary reconfiguration or boundary realignment. This is where two or more lots already exist on one or multiple titles, and there is a benefit to reconfiguring the alignment or the orientation of the boundary of the lots. A common example of this is where a house is built over two lots and you want to retain the house on one title, but free up the other lot so it can be put on a separate title. In this instance, you will need to alter the alignment of the lot boundaries so they no longer cut through the house. See example below. The blue line on the second image is the potential realignment line to create a vacant lot off Warraba Avenue. Because the newly realigned lots still have to comply with the council planning regulations, a boundary reconfiguration typically requires council approval. From a process, cost, and timeframe perspective, a boundary reconfiguration is in between a title lift and a full subdivision, and therefore is an opportunity you need to understand for your area. Subdivision is a great starter project. It teaches you the council application process, project management, consultant coordination, and may or may not include a renovation. However, the biggest reason for preference for subdivisions, particularly small splitters, is that they give you the biggest bang for your buck. A comparatively small subdivision cost outlay gives you almost a free block of land. For this reason, regardless of whether you are intending to do a subdivision as your next deal or not, it is important to consider the characteristics required for a successful subdivision. Keep it small, not a 20-acre land lot in your target area, and list these characteristics in the space below. Remember, there will be location-specific characteristics that will apply to some councils and sites that will not apply to others. Development approval, for example, multi-units. The strategy of development is where council approval is obtained to change the use of the property, typically taking it to a higher use or more intensive use. It might be to change it from a single dwelling house into a multi-unit or townhouse site, or from a vacant block to an industrial shed complex, commercial offices, or a retirement village, just to name a few. Because this approval process alone typically increases the market value of the property and therefore is a manufactured growth strategy on its own, this will be dealt with separate to the construction phase, which will be covered next as a separate strategy. As with subdivision, each council will have their own requirements that need to be complied with in order to obtain a development approval. These requirements will therefore drive the site-specific characteristics that you are looking for in a property and which will be covered in more detail below. Zoning. The most critical characteristic of a site for a development strategy is its zoning. This is because the type of development you are proposing needs to be an approved land use in the zone you are looking in. So let's look at a few examples. If you are looking to do a multi-unit development of, say, three or more dwellings, council may only allow this higher density to be approved in medium density or high density zonings. Therefore, when assessing properties for this strategy, the first criteria is that the property must be located in one of these zones. There is no point looking to do a multi-unit development in an area zoned for low-density residential. Similarly, if your strategy is to get development approval for industrial sheds, you need to be targeting industrial or commercial zoned areas. Remember that the names of the zones will differ between councils, so you need to do your research. The method for determining the zoning of a property was covered in detail under the subdivision section, so won't be covered here again. As you can see in this inserted picture, it's a good idea to look for areas where medium density already exists. It is easier to sell units in an area where there are existing units. The insert is a good example of this, as there are units all around this highlighted property and it is clearly in a medium density zoning. Land size. The size of the block of land is the next most critical characteristic of a property when doing development. This is because council will have a formula based on land size to calculate the number of dwellings or the size of the industrial shed complex that can be developed on a site. In some councils, the formula might be based on a dwelling unit basis, where, for example, a two-bedroom unit requires the equivalent of 200 square metres, whereas a three-bedroom unit requires 300 square metres. Therefore, on an 800 square metre block, you could potentially develop four two-bedroom units, or two three-bedroom units, or two two-bedroom units plus one three-bedroom unit. An alternative calculation method used by council is based on gross floor area. For example, the council may specify that you can develop 50% of the equivalent ground area. Hence, on an 800 square metre block, you can develop 400 square metres of gross floor area, and that may be made up of any configuration of units, for example, all one bedroom or a combination of one, two and three bedroom units, just as long as the total build floor area isn't greater than 400 square metres. Refer to the subdivision section above under land size for a detailed outline of the method for determining a property's land size and searching for property on this basis. Block frontage width. The frontage width of a block, if too narrow, may prevent it being able to be developed. This is something that may be able to be negotiated with council if you do not comply, but it is certainly something you need to be aware of when searching for property. Again, the method for determining the frontage width is detailed above in the subdivision section. Slope, services location, environmental constraints, council overlay restrictions, and capacity to move or demolish an existing dwelling. All of these property characteristics are equally as relevant to a development strategy as they are to a subdivision strategy described above, and so they will not be covered again in detail here. The important thing to be aware of, though, is that these characteristics may affect the number of units able to be developed or the size of the industrial development. For example, a sewer main that cuts through your site may have to have an easement put over it, preventing you from being able to build over it, and hence affecting the layout of your development, and ultimately the number of units or the size of the industrial sheds you are able to get approved. Similarly, a demolition control area may require you to retain the existing dwelling, hence leaving less area able to be developed. Site cover of the existing dwellings if you intend to retain. Retaining an existing dwelling on site may have a significant effect on the potential to further develop the site. There are four main factors affected, which will be detailed below separately. The first factor is the effect of the existing dwelling on the remaining land area available to be developed. Site cover is the term I'm referring to here, which is a measure of the percentage of the land able to be built on and is a key area every council will specify in their planning scheme. For example, council may have a 50% site cover requirement in medium density zones for multi-unit development, in which case on an 800 square metre block, you can only build over a total of 400 square metres of the site. This becomes especially relevant where you intend to retain an existing dwelling on the site, because clearly it is already covering a certain amount of the land area, and you need to factor this into your calculation of the land area left that is able to be developed. For example, retaining the existing house that covers 200 square metres will only leave 200 square metres available land area to be developed, and this will affect the number of units able to be added and their configuration. The second factor is the gross floor area of the dwelling being retained, which for a two-storey dwelling is the total floor area of both levels combined. This is relevant in those councils that use gross floor area in their calculation of the unit density able to be developed. For example, retaining an existing two-storey house with a gross floor area of 300 square metres on a site where you can only develop a total of 400 square metres means you can only develop another 100 square metres gross floor area, which may equate to, say, 2 one-bedroom units or 1 three-bedroom unit. Either way, it has impact on your capacity to develop. The third factor is the number of bedrooms in the existing dwelling, because as I described above, some councils base their density calculation on bedroom number, and so retaining a 4-bedroom house versus a 2-bedroom house will affect the number of additional units able to be developed. The fourth factor is the position of the existing dwelling on the site and how it affects the capacity to physically fit an additional development, and also how it affects that capacity to provide driveway access to council's requirement. This is important because council's requirement for a driveway accessing a single house can be very different from a driveway accessing multi-units. The final aspect to cover here is how you assess in the early stages of your research of a property the site cover, gross floor area, and location of a dwelling you may be considering retaining. The way to do this remotely and as part of your desktop review, even before you have stepped foot on the property, is to use an aerial photo mapping tool like Google Earth, or the mapping tool on realestate.com.au or Investar. By zooming in on the property, you will be able to see the roof area of the dwelling you are considering retaining, and you will be able to use the scale tool to estimate the dimensions, and from there, calculate the parameters above. Yes, this is a very rough method, but it will give you a general guide. Ultimately, a site survey will be required to confirm these measures before lodging with council. If you are considering a multiple dwelling as your next deal, again, it is advisable to start small, maybe do a duplex or possibly a triplex. Whilst bigger numbers of units may produce bigger profits, they also can produce bigger losses, and you need bigger pockets to carry them. List below the characteristics of a property that would be suitable for a multi-unit development, regardless of whether it is to take all the way to completion or to sell off the DA stage. Construction. Whether your strategy is to construct a single house, multi-units, or an industrial complex, the process of construction should increase the value of the property, hence why it's classed as a manufactured growth strategy on its own. The specific property characteristics that are required to undertake construction are very much dictated by what it is you intend to construct. If you are constructing based on a development approval, then the relevant site characteristics have already been detailed in the development section above. Whereas, when you are constructing without the need of a development approval, for example, a single dwelling or even a dual occupancy dwelling, the council will still have requirements that you need to comply with, and you will need to comply with the Building Code of Australia based on the class of building you are constructing. A building designer will know these requirements from a design perspective, and a building certifier will be the person that confirms compliance during construction. The terms used to describe these people and the process may vary between councils and states, but it gives you the general idea. The type of criteria and requirements may include such things as building setbacks, garaging, building height, site cover, etc. Also, you need to be aware of any covenants that may exist on the title, as they may dictate what can be built on the site. This is particularly the case in new developments, where the covenants can dictate the size and look of the building, even down to the colour of the roof. Knowing these council and building code requirements will assist you in researching properties of interest. Strata titling existing buildings. Strata titling an existing building is the process of dividing it up into smaller areas and creating legal title to each, allowing them to be individually owned and sold. For example, a block of 6 units, all on the one title, and therefore owned by the one owner, could potentially be strata titled and divided into 6 individual units, each with individual title that could be owned by different people. An alternative example might be 6 freestanding units that the current owner has chosen to retain on the one title, usually to save on holding costs. Strata titling in this situation would involve separating the 6 units into 6 separate titles. Either way, the principles of strata titling apply equally to residential property like units as it does to strata titling industrial sheds, offices and commercial buildings, and retail shop space to name a few. Because the buildings already exist and are assumed to be council approved, the requirements that need to be complied with for strata titling are more dictated by the Building Code of Australia, although council will also have requirements. For this reason, it can be a bit confusing as to whether it is council, a building certifier or surveyor that assesses the property's compliance with the requirements. In some locations, it is just one, and in other areas, it involves all three, and so you need to research this for your chosen area. Despite who will do the compliance assessment, the requirements for strata titling need to drive the site-specific characteristics that you are looking for in a property, and so these will be covered in more detail below. Before we get onto them, let's cover some of the ways you may search for a residential strata titling deal. Search terms. Searching for a strata title deal generally comes down to the search terms you use and the way you describe the property, whether these are terms used in your internet search or the terms you use to talk with an agent. The process is the same. Searching based on unit blocks is the obvious place to start, and this will generally unearth blocks of units not yet strata titled. The next method is to search based on number of bedrooms, because sometimes a property may be listed as 8 bedrooms, implying that it is an 8 bedroom house, when in fact it is 4 two-bedroom units on the one title. Similarly, another method is to search by number of bathrooms. For example, a property listed as having 6 bathrooms may actually be 6 one-bedroom units. Remember, not every agent is savvy on technology and listing on the internet, and not everyone has sufficient attention to detail, so these errors in description may in fact unearth a potential gem deal, and one that has been overlooked by others. Now that you have located some potential unit block deals, below are a range of site-specific criteria that need to be considered for strata titling. Fire separation between units. When strata titling between units or townhouses or apartments, there will need to be fire separation between the units. What is meant by fire separation is that the walls, floors and ceilings between adjoining units must be constructed using material that complies with the Building Code of Australia, so that a fire in one unit does not easily spread to an adjoining unit. The unit may in fact have been built to comply with this standard when initially constructed, or it may not have, depending on its age. Obviously, where it is already constructed to comply with fire separation, then an inspection from a certifier may be all that is required. If, in contrast, the property was never built to comply with fire regulations, then you will have to do remedial works to bring the property up to standard. This is definitely able to be done, and there are a range of products available to assist with the process. The question, though, is whether it is cost-effective for this deal. Definitely, if you throw enough money at something, you can make it compliant, but you may overcapitalize and lose money in the process. So understanding the characteristics you are looking for is critical. For example, let's take the walls, and here I am referring to the walls adjoining and separating each unit, commonly called the party walls, not the walls internal to the unit. If the party walls are constructed of brick, see the photo below, or blockwork, then this is the most compliant material, and the main aspect to confirm is whether the walls adjoin each unit, run right the way through the ceiling to the underside of the roofing material, and hence achieving full separation from floor to roof. Sometimes the walls stop at the ceiling and there is a gap in the roof cavity, and work needs to be done to achieve the full height separation. Alternatively, if the walls are made of lightweight material, for example timber frame and wall sheeting, see the photo below, there may be the need to upgrade this material to achieve the necessary fire rating. Accessing the roof cavity and looking down onto the walls will assist with determining the construction material and if it is fire compliant. The other aspect with the party walls is whether electrical cables or water pipes penetrate the walls, because if so, there is the potential for fire to spread along these lines and preventative materials like fire collars may need to be installed. So from this description, you can see that being aware of the dividing wall material and construction method is vital when considering strata titling. It is not hard to ascertain though, and a lot can be gleaned from photos, although an actual site inspection will be essential to confirm. Now we need to consider the flooring material from a fire separation perspective. The flooring material is especially relevant where you have one unit above another unit, or a unit above a car park or garage that does not belong to that unit. The reason for this is because there is the capacity for fire to spread through the floor and affect occupants of other units. In contrast, the flooring material within your own unit that separates different levels of your own space and garage carport does not need to achieve the same level of fire separation. So what you are looking for here is dividing floors constructed of suspended concrete slab, as this is highly fire resistant. In contrast, timber floors will typically not achieve the necessary fire rating and can also be quite expensive to fire rate and may make the deal unviable. There definitely are new products always coming on the market that can be retrofitted to achieve the necessary fire rating, although they come at a cost. Again, photographs can often reveal the type of flooring material, as can pulling up a small corner of the floor covering when it's carpet or vinyl. Looking up at the underside of the floor from the garage or car park below can also give you an indication of the material type. Again, any sign of services running through the floors to other units should flag the need for further investigations. The roof construction can be another indicator of whether further fire separation works may be required. In particular, if the building has a very flat roof or an older skillion roof, it may in fact have no roof or ceiling cavity at all. If this is the case, often you will find that the services like electricity are not running through the ceiling between units because it doesn't exist, and instead the wiring may run through the walls between the units, again flagging the need for rectification works. Whether it's the floors, walls, roofing or penetrating services, ultimately an inspection will need to be conducted by a building certifier to guide you on what works may be required to achieve the necessary fire separation for strata titling. Position of existing stairs, window openings and car parking. Additional features of the existing building that may impact on its capacity to be strata titled or the amount of rectification works required include the position of the existing stairs, window openings and car parks. Again, these all relate back to the spread of fire and the positioning of these items to ensure that fire cannot be easily spread from, say, one unit window to the next unit, or that the fire in one unit does not hinder access to the communal stairs and prevent emergency exit for neighbouring units. Similarly, it is required that a fire in a garage, carport or car park of one unit does not damage an adjoining unit or property, or indeed prevent emergency access to and from adjoining units. Whether the property complies with the necessary requirements may be less easily identified to the untrained eye, but certainly being aware of them is valuable to at least inform future investigations. Existence of separately metered services. A common council requirement needing to be complied with when strata titling is the provision of separately metered services. This is definitely the case with electricity, and all councils will require each unit to have their own power meter or sub-meter if they are to be separately strata titled. Water is less cut and dried though, and some councils will allow units to share common water meters, whereas others will require them each to be individually metered. Similarly with gas, some areas will require it to be separately metered. Where the units are not currently separately metered, there may be the need to undertake these works as part of the strata titling process. Identifying if the units are separately metered or not for power, water and gas is generally not that difficult, as there will be meters on site for each of these services, and you just need to identify what units they are servicing. Obviously, the services of a plumber, electrician and gas fitter may be required to confirm the situation, depending on the complexity of the setup. Capacity to reconfigure units and add bedrooms, or split units into smaller units. When looking at potential strata titled deals, you also want to focus on the configuration of the units and whether additional bedrooms can be added, or whether larger units could be split into smaller units. Making these types of alterations may trigger the need for council approval, as they may be considered substantial alterations to the existing unit and may necessitate additional car parking, additional private open space area, and the list goes on. For this reason, understanding these impacts early on will inform your future decisions and the property characteristics to target. For example, if your council uses gross floor area as their method for determining unit density, then adding a bedroom into the same unit floor area may not trigger the need for council approval, whereas in another council that bases its unit density calculation on number of bedrooms, then clearly adding a bedroom could trigger the need for council approval. Vacant land to further develop. The final site-specific characteristic to be discussed is the presence of vacant land adjacent to the unit block. This land creates a potential opportunity to add additional units or to subdivide it off to create another property. Either way, understanding the council requirements for developing multi-units and for subdivision will guide you in this process, as discussed in the previous sections of this module. Strata titling is another easy strategy to start with as your first project. Strata titling is cost-effective, income-producing, rent, while you change the titling, a clean strategy, relatively easy to do if you pick the right property. Make a list of the key characteristics you are looking for in a great strata title deal.